Before we dive in, a brief word about what this episode actually is and isn't. It doesn't track church history in the traditional sense. We're not visiting councils or reviewing heresies or doing a bio of colorful bishops for the next several minutes. What we're doing instead is stepping back to take a broad look at the European Enlightenment. We have to, because the ideas birthed in this era, they didn't just shape theology, they shaped the modern world. You can't understand where the church went in the 18th and 19th centuries without understanding the intellectual atmosphere that it was breathing. The Thirty Years' War ended in 1648 with the Peace of Westphalia. If you've been following this series, you know that war was a catastrophe of almost unimaginable proportions. Theologically motivated, politically amplified, and utterly exhausting. When the guns finally fell silent, Europe didn't exactly celebrate. It collapsed into a chair and reached for something strong. The decades that followed were by no means peaceful. There was the English Civil War, the execution of Charles I, the occasional smaller European conflict to keep things interesting. But a new spirit was beginning to brew. People were weary of religious tension, weary of scholastic hair splitting, and deeply suspicious of the occult mysticism that the Renaissance trailed behind it. By the mid-17th century, the seeds of the Enlightenment were well and truly sown. Europe, well, was ready to try something different, something rational, something they hoped was a bit less bloody. To understand what was happening intellectually, you have to appreciate how dramatically the political landscape had shifted in just 50 years. At the dawn of the 16th century, Spain was the dominant superpower of Europe. In 1492 alone, quite the banner year, Spain expelled the last Muslim strongholds from the Iberian Peninsula and stumbled across the New World. Not bad. But by the mid-17th century, Spain was exhausted and spent, its imperial ambitions having cost it dearly in the Thirty Years' War. Hegemony shifted to France, finally free of the crushing pressure from its powerful neighbors to the south and east. Meanwhile, the Netherlands, previously a Spanish possession, won their independence with the Treaty of Westphalia and promptly became, almost overnight, the world's leading trading nation. Amsterdam became the financial capital of the globe. The Dutch merchant fleet was the largest on the planet. These were the people who had invented the stock market, and they were quite happy about it. The Islamic threat, which loomed over Europe for centuries, was now finally receding. Of course, Constantinople, that longtime capital of the Eastern Roman Empire, had fallen to the Ottoman Turks in 1453, a wound that Christendom really never stopped grieving. But 1683 brought one of history's great underdog moments. The Polish king Jan Sobieski, outnumbered 5-1, routed the Ottoman army besieging Vienna. The tide had finally turned. The new Europe, it was a continent of independent nations, of rising trade, of growing middle classes, and a novel experiment called the balance of power. The Pope's political teeth had been pulled, even in Catholic countries, by the Peace of Westphalia, which permitted each state to follow its own religion. The age of a single authority, whether that be emperor or pope, governing the whole continent, that was over. And in its place arose something new, a world in which nationhood, human rights, and law would increasingly need to be justified on rational grounds rather than religious ones. It took the Dutch 80 years of on and off warfare before they finally secured their independence from Spain in 1648, but the effort, of course, was worth it. Within a generation, the Netherlands entered a golden age in trade, in art, in science, and in something rarer still, in tolerance. In the 17th century Dutch masters, they were producing paintings to rival the Italian Renaissance. Dutch theologians were defining and refining Reformed orthodoxy. And their merchants, well, they were getting fabulously rich. Because the country was run by merchants rather than monarchs or bishops, it became a refuge for almost everyone. A substantial Jewish community fleeing Philip II's persecutions in Spain settled there. The future King Charles II of England took shelter there after his father's execution. Fringe philosophers like Descartes and his disciple Spinoza found in the Netherlands the one thing that they couldn't find elsewhere, the freedom to think out loud without getting arrested for it. And one fascinating figure from this time was the Dutch Reformed thinker Hugo Grotius, who championed syncretism, the idea that Christians of all denominations should unite around their shared faith and heritage. It was a noble vision. It was a compelling idea. But the Dutch Calvinists who ran the country had him thrown in prison for it, which rather, I think, proved his point. Grotius made a daring escape by hiding in a chest of books. Despite his theology, he's best remembered today as the father of international law. His 1625 treatise on the law of peace and war argued for binding legal principles transcending national boundaries, grounded not in divine authority, but in, well, natural reason. It was, in many ways, what the Enlightenment would eventually make front and center. If one man could claim to be the most powerful individual on earth in the late 17th century, it was Louis XIV of France, the Sun King. He ascended to the throne at the age of 4 in 1643 and stayed there until 1715, a reign of 72 years that still holds the European record. When Cardinal Mazarin, who was essentially Louis's prime minister, died in 1661, the 23-year-old Louis decided not to replace him. He would run France himself. Now, whether or not he actually uttered the words, "I am the state," the sentiment was entirely within his character. His palace at Versailles, completed in 1682, after 2 decades of construction, it was a monument to the spirit of the age. Formalism, geometry, beauty, intellect. And where France led, Europe followed. Scholars who'd corresponded in Latin for centuries switched to French. It was that kind of cultural gravity. Now, Louis's favorite slogan was, "One faith, one law, one king." The Catholicism of France at that time was more nationalistic than papal. Devotion to the church rooted in France's ancient heritage rather than loyalty to Rome. Historians called this Gallicanism, and one of its most eloquent voices at court was Bishop Jacques Bossuet, a man of genuine piety and eloquence who tried to moderate the king's harsher impulses. He tried, but he failed. Of France's roughly 15 million, the largest population of any European state at that time, about 1 million were Calvinists, the Huguenots. Their right to worship had been guaranteed by the Edict of Nantes since 1598. Louis proceeded to make their lives miserable anyway, restricting where they could live, work, worship, study. In 1681, the oppression became outright suppression when the army was ordered to harass the Huguenots until they converted. 4 years later, he revoked the Edict of Nantes, and hundreds of thousands of France's most productive citizens, merchants, craftsmen, soldiers, they left France. A growing number of French intellects, well, they began to suspect that religion, as practiced by their government, didn't offer much of a foundation for an enlightened modern society. Somewhat further, and questioned whether religion offered much at all. And so they looked across the channel at their Dutch and English neighbors, who seemed to have worked out a far more sensible arrangement. England had been having its own chaotic century. Civil war, a short-lived republic, the execution of a king, the restoration of his son, the overthrow of that son's brother, and finally the invitation extended to the Dutch William of Orange to invade and take the throne, all in the name of securing a Protestant monarchy. The 17th century was hardly boring for the English. Out of the political turmoil that came at that time was a potent political philosophy. British thinkers began working out ideas about government and liberty that would prove revolutionary, quite literally, in the case of America and France, at least. The key insight, born of hard experience, was this: kings rule by the consent of the governed. The people retain the right to judge their rulers and even remove them. This was a radical thought in a world still accustomed to the divine right of kings. Thomas Hobbes got the ball rolling with his book Leviathan in 1651. It's not a cheerful read. Hobbes argued that government rests on natural law, not divine sanction, and exists only by the will of the people. His vision of human nature was grim. Life without government, he said, was, quote, "solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short," unquote. But his political framework was thoroughly secular. The more influential figure was John Locke. If Hobbes was the Enlightenment's midwife, Locke was the one who actually delivered it, cleaned it up, and then presented it to the world. Now, Locke was inspired above all by science. and specifically by Isaac Newton, whom England regarded as a national treasure, a new Aristotle in modern dress. Newton's Principia Mathematica said, "The final word on physics, through the sheer exercise of cool mathematical reason, ought to rule." Locke's burning question was, what might that same exercise of reason produce in politics, in ethics, in religion? And the answers that he came up with essentially launched the English Enlightenment single-handedly. Locke argued that human reason should be the final arbiter of what we believe in every sphere of life. Tolerance, individual liberty, education, freedom were not merely nice ideals. They were the necessary conditions for reason to flourish. Locke's greatest impact was not in England, but on the continent, and especially in France, where intellectuals read him with a growing sense of reverence. And this brings us to the man who, more than any other single figure, embodied the Enlightenment spirit, and I might say its excesses, François-Marie Arouet, better known by his pen name, Voltaire. Born in Paris in 1694 and educated by the Jesuits, who gave him an excellent education and a lifelong suspicion of religious institutions, Voltaire became famous for his satirical poetry and his spectacular inability to hold his tongue around people with power. His mockery of the French aristocracy landed him in the Bastille for a year. That wasn't enough to teach him caution, and in 1726 he was exiled. He spent 3 years in England, and what he found there, liberalism, rationalism, religious tolerance, Newton and Locke, transformed him. On his return to France in 1729, Voltaire set out to enlighten his countrymen by praising everything England had that France lacked. His philosophical lectures of 1734, which he cheerfully called the first bomb against the old regime, compared French government, science, and philosophy unfavorably to English equivalents in almost every category. And as we'd expect, he was again expelled from Paris and retreated to the French countryside, buried himself in the natural sciences, spent some years at the invitation of Frederick the Great in Prussia, and eventually settled in Switzerland, where he churned out plays and novels, essays, and polemics. His estate became a place of pilgrimage for the leading minds and celebrities of Europe. He was known as the innkeeper of Europe. In 1778, he returned to Paris to direct one of his plays. He received a hero's welcome from the public and died shortly after, having decided that Paris was an acceptable place to do that. Voltaire's lifelong slogan was, "Crush infamy." And the most infamous institution in France, by his reckoning anyway, was the Roman Catholic Church. Now, we need to be careful here. Voltaire was not an atheist. He was a deist. He believed in a creator God, a kind of divine watchmaker who set the universe in motion and then apparently decided to mind his own business. What Voltaire despised was institutional religion, the dogmas, the authority, the superstition, as he considered it, and the willingness to persecute. He attacked Christianity's doctrines and practices with the same ferocity that he brought to mocking secular rulers. There's a story, likely true given the man involved, that his local bishop once issued an order that Voltaire was under no circumstance to be admitted to Mass. Now, Voltaire, who had no intention of letting a bishop exercise authority over him, solved the problem by faking a terminal illness and demanding the last sacraments. No priest could deny a dying man the sacrament, so Voltaire received communion, and the moment he swallowed it, he jumped out of bed and went for a walk. The idea that one could literally eat God struck him as simultaneously blasphemous and absurd, and mockery was his natural response to what he regarded as absurdity. By his death, Voltaire had produced some 2,000 books and pamphlets. His greatest was probably the Philosophical Dictionary of 1764, devoted primarily to ethical and religious subjects, and promptly burned throughout France, which was, if nothing else, proof that people were reading it. Because Voltaire looms so large, it's easy to treat the French Enlightenment as a one-man show. It certainly was not. He was just the loudest voice in a chorus. These French intellectuals called themselves the philosophes, not quite philosophers in the academic sense, but public intellectuals committed to reason, to progress, and the dismantling of what they saw as an irrationally based authority. The first among them was Baron Montesquieu, whose Persian Letters of 1721 used the clever device of two fictional Persian travelers writing home about their observations of Europe. The letters allowed Montesquieu to savage the French king, the French government, French society, and the Catholic Church without quite putting his own name on the insults. His satire goes, it was pretty elegant. His later work, The Spirit of the Laws, in 1748, was a more serious attempt to establish rational legal principles and showed more sympathy in its treatment of Christianity. People occasionally grow up, even, apparently, philosophers. But not everyone moderated with age. Baron de Holbach went the other direction. While Voltaire was a deist, de Holbach was a full-blown atheist, a daring proposition in 18th century France. He argued in his System of Nature that atheism was the only rational foundation for ethics. He proposed that the universe was entirely material and mechanical. There was no God, no soul, no divine purpose behind creation. It was the complete inversion of everything that Bossuet had stood for a century earlier. The distance between de Holbach and Bossuet is the distance the French Enlightenment had traveled from Catholic devotion to confident atheism in three generations. Listen, next time we head to Germany, where the Enlightenment took on a distinctly different flavor, shaped by the Lutheran tradition, Pietist influence, and a cast of philosophical characters who would ultimately shake the theological world far more profoundly than even Voltaire managed. I want to end where we began, with a reminder of why we're digging into the Enlightenment in these two episodes. We are, because we need to account for the theological liberalism that arose as an answer to the challenge of the Enlightenment. It's that theological liberalism that has hollowed out mainline Protestant denominations and sparked the two great movements that I suspect many, if not most, of those watching are today a part of.